This is a podcast from BBC Radio's news and sports station,
5Live.
To find out more about 5Live and its sister service, 5Live Sports Extra, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5Live.
The good doctor is here, dressed as a country and western artist, as he often is. And of course, you blend in particularly well with the members of the MCC here.
I got into the lift and somebody said to me, no jeans. They were wearing jeans, so I think it was basically no jeans with that hair and that shirt.
Who said no jeans? Who was it?
But I don't know, it may have been a famous person, but as you know, my total knowledge of famous cricketing people is fairly limited.
Didn't know there was a dress code.
Oh yeah, you're wearing jeans as well.
Jeans.
Difference is, you
jeans.
Look like rubbish, but I look like Glen Campbell.
So you can... Is that what you aspire to, is it? Box office top 10 this week include the following. At 10, Shortcut. That's cut, K-U-T, so possibly...
Well, we're calling for a review of it. Both number 10, Shortcut, and number 9, well, last week we were told that number 9 was...
A sexist pile of rubbish, really.
Sexist pile of rubbish.
Essentially, that's what it boiled down to. Although this from Suki says, Mark, I would love it if you'd actually go and watch Kambakht Ishq. Went to see it on Monday and thought it was brilliant, but I've heard some people who don't like it. It would be great to get a fresh opinion on this film, as most people I've heard review it are typical Bollywood film reviewers.
Well, I'll tell you what, in that case, since I've been asked, I will go and see it between now and next Friday.
But as you've explained before, they don't get press screenings.
Why hasn't that changed?
Well,
no, it has changed for some, but not for all. That's the way it works out. So some do, some don't.
So which of the reviewers I should get on the programme then who are included?
No. It doesn't work like that. It's that some of them, some of those Bollywood distributors do national press show the films. Some of them don't.
And some don't. So yeah. We need to go...
Eros with a big sort of breakthrough.
So by this time next week, maybe Kambakht-ish
I'll check it out.
You'll pay?
Yeah, I can pay. I can do that.
Claim it back on expenses?
Unlikely
indeed. Night at the Museum 2 is at 8.
Boring.
Year 1 is at 7.
Boring and nothing like as funny as it ought to be.
My Sister's Keeper is at 6.
Boring, and frankly Cameron Diaz shouldn't be doing this sort of thing. She should be doing that, you know, ditzy screwball comedy for which she is so loved.
At 5, Public Enemies and Dr. Sandy Nelson, MBCHBDGM.
Yes.
Says, dear Jake and Elwood, long time listener, first time caller. Okay. On an email. Inspired to do so by the acuity of Dr. K's Public Enemies review, he succinctly, an achievement in itself for him, captured all the reasons I too had problems with the film. The digital shooting style is so cold and cheap-looking, it breaks the fourth wall and never lets the viewer immerse themselves in the film. It is a huge problem that detracts from an otherwise well-made movie, not on the same level as previous man works, such as Heat and Last of the Mohicans, but still far better than most of the dross out there. And as Mark says, Marion Cotillard is simply wonderful, an effervescent and compulsive performance that deserves much more screen time.
Very good. I have nothing to add to that. I mean, except very briefly that some people have complained that there's nothing wrong with the modernity of the digital shooting, that obviously isn't innately anachronistic. It's wrong to believe that period movies should have a period look to them. I just think it's out of whack with the drama, and I agree that it's cold.
But that's like saying it's wrong to listen to a punk record on CD.
No, exactly. That's why I just said that...
But that's a silly opinion, because all the CD does is reproduce the sound in a more accurate way than your 7-inch piece of vinyl.
Yes, but the thing is that digital photography looks completely different to cellular. You're absolutely right. There is no reason why you shouldn't be able to make a period movie with a digital camera. That's perfectly fine. But in this particular style, the handheld, you know, very kind of in-your-face... up to the minute Lars von Trier does the Untouchable style, I don't think quite works.
Let's whiz through, then we can do Moon, then we'll update on The Gulf, and then come back with Harry Potter, just so that people know where we are. The Hangover
boring.
Is at 4, but everyone else thinks it's very funny.
Boring.
Transformers 2 is at 3.
Well, a very interesting article recently that says that Transformers is the most militarised movie of all time, which just adds to reasons to dislike it. And incidentally, can I ask right now for the a boycott on the further Antichrist Michael Bay jokes, because Antichrist is coming out next week, people have started making, because I said that Michael Bay was Damien, which I believe to be true.
All right, I don't think that's going to be too difficult
more Michael Bay Antichrist.
Ice Age 3D is at 2.
I thought you were Ice Age as in I say tomatoes and you say tomato.
No, Ice Age, the end of narrative cinema as we know it,
and
at 2.
And proof that 3D is, you know, we're all just chasing our tails with it. It's not the future of cinema. Sorry, there we go.
And Bruno is the number one movie, presumably in its 18 certificate mode, and
yes,
then it'll go to a 15 and then be even more popular.
It has been recut to a 15. I think it took very little, apparently. It took like a minute and a half out of it in order to make it a 15 certificate film. But I would think this just kind of gives weight to the sense with Bruno that if there was a philosophical thing behind Sacha Baron Cohen's satire, it has been to some extent compromised both by the involvement of celebrities who are now in on the joke and by the recutting of the movie in order to maximise its box office potential. I remember the last time this happened, funnily enough, was Mel Gibson recutting The Passion of the Christ, having said, this is how it was, this is how it was, this is how it was. Oh, here's a 15 certificate version of how it was. He went to all that trouble to tell us that there was a really good religious reason for nailing a man to a wall for 2 hours, and then did a softer version because some of us didn't want to see that.
So that's the box office top 10. We'll get to Harry Potter after the next golf update. But Moon is also out this week. So why don't we do Moon?
Okay, sure.
And then we'll build ourselves up to the Harry Potter 6.
So Moon is the debut feature by Duncan Jones, who came on the show when we did the programme from Edinburgh. And as you've said before, there was a little discussion at the beginning about how long we could go into the interview with Duncan Jones before mentioning who Duncan Jones was. Now, before we mention who Duncan Jones was, let me say that when I saw Moon, I didn't realise who Duncan Jones was, but you leapt in and said that.
Well, he made a reference
to his father.
To his father, and yeah, the fact that when he was a young boy, he and his father used to make films together. When that seemed to be a perfect point to point out to everybody
that his father's
David Bowie,
okay,
which seemed relevant.
And also, it is interesting that him having made a film called Moon, which incidentally coincides, obviously, you may have noticed if you had a radio on in the last sort of few weeks, that this is the anniversary of the moon landings. He was obviously thinking about movies which came out around the same time that his father had recorded Space Oddity. So consequently, several reviews have come under the very, very punning title Space Oddity, as if nobody had thought of that before. But let's put all that out of the way. Having looked at the movie as I did without knowing who Duncan Jones was, here's what I saw. Story about a guy in the future, near future, working a small mining colony on the far side of the moon, therefore having lost contact with Earth for a while. And he is coming to the end of his contract. He has no direct contact with Earth, but there are signals sent back from his wife, from whom he is estranged because of the time that he's been away, but he is looking forward to getting back to his wife and child after having had a long period of loneliness out on the lunar surface. Then an accident occurs. The next thing that happens is he wakes up back in the moon base in perfect health, then goes out and rescues himself. Finds himself back in the moon base with two versions of himself, a perfectly functioning version and a slightly battered up version. And the only person who can explain anything is the HAL-like computer voiced by Kevin Spacey. Here's a clip.
What the hell's going on? Who's the guy in the rec room? Where did he come from? Why does he look like me?
Sam, you're out of bed.
Yeah, Gertie, I'm out of bed. Who's the guy in the rec room?
Sam Bell.
Come on.
You are Sam Bell. Sam, what is it? It might help to talk about it.
I don't understand what's happening. This is my mind.
We could run some tests. I haven't let Sam contact Lunar. They don't know you were recovered alive from the accident.
Recovered alive? What do you mean? Why have you reported to Central? What are you talking about?
I'm here to keep you safe, Sam. Are you hungry?
Now, two things. Firstly, it is funny, isn't it, how Kevin Spacey can sound sinister even when simply asking, are you hungry? And obviously that relates to the HAL computer from 2001, in which Are you saying obviously sarcastically, or... if that's what you thought?
I think an onboard space computer is going to...
immediately sound like the voice of 2001. So. Well, does that work with the space computer in Alien, in which it's called Mother, therefore it's a different gender, which fundamentally changes that relationship?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. So all space computers in movies
apart from Marvin the Paranoid Android.
Yes, who's clearly not an onboard space computer, but is a robot, which is completely different.
It.
Okay, so...
there'll be a golf update.
I was really impressed by Moon for a number of reasons, primarily because, as with all the best science fiction movies, it is a film about ideas in which the science fiction trappings are just used as a framework for those ideas. It is essentially about the great loneliness of space and the idea that when you go out into the unknown, what you end up being confronted with is yourself. I mean, it's interesting how many science fiction movies are about the search for God or the search for the spirit or the search for the soul. And of course 2001 itself ends up in that enigmatic place in which Stanley Kubrick just kind of gives up, throws everything. We have a light show and then Bowman goes off into some other place and becomes the star child, which some people have chosen to interpret religiously. Of course in the Arthur C. Clarke version it's nothing like that at all. In the Arthur C. Clarke version actually he is adapted into the next breed of humanity and sent back to Earth to destroy all the nuclear weapons that have proliferated on Earth. Moon is much more enigmatic. It is very much in the same vein as Tarkovsky's Solaris. It has a similar feel to Silent Running, which, as you know, I love above all science fiction movies, which is It's stylistically similar in that you have Bruce Dern cast adrift in space with no one to talk to but the little walking robots. In this, you have Sam Rockwell cast adrift in space with no one to talk to but that computer, which is voiced by Kevin Spacey.
You don't have Joni Mitchell warbling on, do you?
You don't, and I think that's a problem.
No,
I mean, the two.
I like her, but she warbles in that other film.
The two things that would have improved Moon, he said, continuing anyway, is obviously if the lead role had been played by Jason Isaacs, which generally it improves everything, and hello to Jason Isaacs, incidentally, is that a little bit of Joni Mitchell on the soundtrack would have gone a long way. But it also reminded me of things like Soylent Green, the kind of conspiracy element of Soylent Green. But interestingly enough, all the films that it reminds me of are early 70s paranoid dystopian sci-fi thrillers. And he was too young to watch those the first time round. I mean, he's from the Blade Runner generation.
Daniel in Northumberland, dear Dr. Strangelove and Captain Mandrake, can't wait for the Moon review. Perhaps hold a sweepstake for how long Mark goes without mentioning Silent Running. I bet 20 seconds. Well, actually, it turned out to be a 4.5 minutes. But Daniel, appreciate the text. The movie of the week, as far as the publicity, as far as the press, as far as the posters are concerned, a lot of people have seen it already because it opened on Wednesday. It's the 6th Harry Potter film.
The 6th of 8, of course, because we know that the last one is going to be divided into 2 movies, which I have to say I'm kind of quite pleased about, because there's an awful lot of plot to get through in the last book, and you can't...
There's an awful lot of plot in all of them, and that's one of the issues to
okay.
be discussed.
All right, fine. So before we do that, so the 6th, as you said, and it needs to be said right at the beginning, the least Jason Isaacs possible, because...
It's a bit of a weakness, isn't it?
He's in Azkaban the whole time, and so consequently the Jason Isaacs rating on the movie is nil, and that obviously is going to lose it some support. But there we go, it's just the nature of the book.
Now,
right?
we started this conversation last week, so and it maybe went as further than it should have done,
yeah.
So that for everyone else's purposes,
benefit
and purposes, we are going to be talking about this film, and we will refer to a certain incident as
the unhappy event.
The unhappy event. Okay.
Okay.
So there is a certain unhappy event which will be discussed because it's impossible not to. But
it
that's
is
how it will be.
But
referred
we will
to.
Discuss it as the unhappy event. But essentially, the nuts and bolts you need to know: Voldemort's rise continuing, Harry continuing to wrestle with his destiny and his humanity. Dumbledore, meanwhile, on the trail of Horcruxes, which I have to say, of all the inventions in Harry Potter are the one which ring most true. I mean, I know J.K. Rowling is very, very good at coming up with ideas and devices which have slightly sort of punny names, but Horcruxes are just a great idea.
We can
explain what a Horcrux is, can't we?
Yes.
Yes, fine, because we're not giving away plot points. So essentially, the idea of a Horcrux is that one of the reasons that Voldemort has been able to come back, one of the reasons that Voldemort is indefeatable, is that he has split his soul and saved little bits of his soul in items, in artifacts, in places. And consequently, if he dies, a little bit of him continues. But in order to split his soul, he has to do something terrible. And the terrible thing that he has to do is to commit murder. And in the tearing apart of the soul, obviously, one ceases to be a whole person. Consequently, Voldemort, who has created Horcruxes of himself, is both less than a person and also more than mortal.
And as a horror man, that's a new idea.
There are horror precedents for the idea of burying the soul within relics. The idea of splitting the soul to bury it within relics is, I think, is a really good one.
And a Horcrux.
The word Horcrux is fantastic. And in fact, as soon as you hear the word Horcrux, you think, I have to use that in conversation as soon as is humanly possible, because it is one of those things that's going to outlive the Harry Potter books, is the idea
of
the
Horcrux. How are you going to put that into everyday conversation? Oh, I just put the flowers in the Horcrux over there.
No, you can't put
flowers
in a Horcrux.
Look what they gave me at work, a retirement present. Yes. I got a gold-plated Horcrux.
Yes, the new Transformers movie is like a very Horcrux. Okay. It contains within it 1/7 of Voldemort's distraught and hideous soul. Anyway, so significant details also play out in flashback, because the idea is that what we're doing during the course of this is learning more about the history of Voldemort in order to understand how to destroy him. Here's a scene in which, with the pensive, which is something in which you can watch memories, the younger Dumbledore meets the much younger Tom Riddle, who, as you will all know, grows up to be Voldemort. Here's a clip.
You're the doctor, aren't you?
No. I'm a professor.
I don't believe you. She wants me looked at. They think I'm different.
Well, perhaps they're right.
I'm not mad.
Hogwarts is not a place for mad people. Hogwarts is a school. A school of magic. You can do things, can't you, Tom? Things other children can't.
I can make things move without touching them. I can make animals do what I want without training them. I can make bad things happen to people who are mean to me. can make them hurt. If I want. Who are you?
Well, I'm like you, Tom. I'm different.
Prove it.
And indeed.
And he does.
He does.
See that wardrobe?
See, yes. Okay, so, just the nuts and bolts stuff. We have Jim Broadbent as Horace Slughorn, who's the potions professor, who is brought in partly because of what he knows about potions, but more significantly because of what he remembers about Voldemort. Now, here's an interesting thing. I think that some of the response to the new movie has not been entirely positive. I've certainly read a couple of reviews that said, well, this is kind of a bit lackluster. There's an awful lot of plot. In fact, you yourself said just a minute ago, there is an awful lot of plot to get through, okay? I'm going to lay my cards on the table with one reservation, which we'll come to regarding the unhappy event. I think this is the second best Potter movie that I've seen.
Behind Azkaban?
Behind Azkaban. I still think Azkaban, in many ways, Azkaban is an easier nut to crack because it's, as far as the condensing of the material is concerned for the purpose of a movie, it is more self-contained. I mean, this, we have now got to a point in the story when there are so many threads running simultaneously that actually, it of course it feels episodic because there's neither a beginning nor an end, although this does have a climax. I thought that, watching it, two things. Firstly, I thought, when I was a kid, why didn't people make movies like this for me? Because it was the closest I've seen to a kid's horror film, a proper kid's horror film, in as much as a film about good versus evil, and the idea of evil itself existing as a concept rather than just something which has to be, you know, just fought with fists, which is the kind of Transformers movie. So, number one. The second thing, actually in relation to that, some of the members of the cast have talked about how after the darkness of the last one, this was a little bit of kind of light relief, which I didn't feel it was at all. I think what it is it's a better movie. And the last movie, I thought, did suffer from the problem of too much plot, Your Majesty, and too many notes, and too many things that you actually had to get in, and too much condensing. In the case of this, considering how unwieldy the book is, and necessarily unwieldy, I thought, firstly, they did a really good job with the screenplay of condensing the stuff down. And secondly, I thought from a directorial point of view, he did a really good job of getting that sense of an impending catastrophe, of an impending meeting of good and evil. Now, a lot of press attention has been given to the fact that the Vatican, you know, sort of said, whether officially or unofficially, that this is they're kind of happy with it. Now, you know, at the very beginning of the Harry Potter stuff, there was a lot of fuss about whether the Catholic Church were against the idea of anything about wizards and magic. That was all bad. And now they've come around and said, well, in fact, we think that this is about good and evil. I know it's very...
Well spotted.
No, I know. And I know it's...
Almost a decade to work
it's
that one
out. And obviously, it's easy to sneer, as you just have done. And I'm kind of with you. I'm not Catholic, and I'm with you on that, because the fact is that anybody who thought that this wasn't about that is foolish. But it is significant that this is the moment at which they finally caught up, because it's so clearly about more than just the action that's happening. It is so clearly about something which is virtually existential that there's no way you could possibly misinterpret it. But it is still playing to an audience who, I think, you know, it's not for very young kids, because there are ideas in it that I find very disturbing. There are sequences in it that are very worrying. There is one particular sequence in it which I think we'll discuss after
we'll do it.
But generally, and with the exception of two things, one which we'll talk about, and secondly, the absence of Jason Isaacs, no fault of the filmmakers, nothing they could do about that. Although they did invent a scene that didn't, you know.
Well,
I think it's the second best.
Okay, and we'll get to the problem. And unfortunately, the problem is quite a big problem, because it's essentially the last 10-15 minutes, and it revolves around the unhappy event. We've got lots and lots of emails from people who've seen it. Lots of tweets have come in as well. We're halfway through. Well, three quarters, 7/8 of the way through our Harry Potter conversation. Harry Potter 6 came out on Wednesday. You've already said you think it's the second best behind Prisoner of Azkaban. We'll come to the reservations in just a second.
Okay. The other stuff that I think that's really worth noting, firstly, is directed by David Yates, who I obviously did, you know, the previous one, Phoenix, which I did have some reservations about largely, that I thought that was, you know, too much plot. And I think there's a real demonstration of having got to grips with the material. I think he's now, you know, obviously working on the last two. I think it's very interesting how when that cast was chosen, they would have been very, very young, and who could have told that they were going to grow up as well as they have done on screen? I mean, people have talked about watching them grow up on screen. Actually, I think the most impressive thing is that of the central players, they've all turned into pretty solid, accomplished actors, and you really do believe those roles. And it's kind of odd that none of them have fallen by the way. I think they hold their own very well. Tom Felton, particularly in this one, who you see as Draco Malfoy, who comes center stage, and actually does a really, really good job with a very difficult role. Because up until now, he's been, you know, he's on the side. Of course, he's having to hold his own against Snape, which is in many ways the most attractive role, and also the most complex role, and also the one that everybody, you know, obviously it's doing the written thing here. So generally, from a cast point of view, from a point of view of the way it looks, from a point of view, most importantly, of getting through that material, marshalling and making something which in the middle of the story essentially changes direction and goes off in a different way, I thought it was a really good, really solid job of making a film for older children, I stress the older children, that deals with good and evil in a way that is both palatable and slightly scary, which I really like.
The reason why I think some people will leave feeling, oh no, that, I don't think that's really worked,
is
because the last 15 minutes doesn't work, and it doesn't work because now we're going to refer to the unhappy event. There is a very, very unhappy event towards the end of this movie. But the unhappy event relies on one crucial plot point, and that is the fact that Harry has been paralysed in the book and therefore cannot take action against this unhappy event. And just a big appeal for a wicket anyway. The umpire's not interested.
No.
And he's invisible because he's under his invisibility cloak. So the whole reason why he doesn't step in and take action against the unhappy event is because he can't. Whereas here, he's just looking on and not doing anything, and that doesn't make sense because we know he's a brave...
Well, here's what I would say about this, and again, for those who don't know, as I said, we are referring to this as the unhappy event. It's a very difficult scene to do. It is different in the book. You are quite right that on film, it is a crucial difference in that Harry doesn't intervene because he's told not to intervene, whereas in the book, he physically cannot intervene. Now, I wonder whether this is going to have some significance further on down the road, and I have to say that the...
I think you're being charitable there.
Yeah, that's possibly true. I think it says something about how much I like the rest of the movie, that when we got to something which with another head on, I would have said, well, that's it, you can't fumble that moment, I would have felt that was completely wrong. What I felt was a sense of confusion. Now, that is not to say that the unhappy event does not still contain great unhappiness, which it does, nor to say that I came out feeling dissatisfied. I came out feeling I can't quite figure out why it was that they did it in that way.
Here is an email which gets to some of the matter. Simon from Ilkley in West Yorkshire.
And it's not giving away plot details.
Well, it does, but I'll busk it. Dear Greden Forge, Harry Potter 6. Love the books, was really looking forward to the film. Not overly impressed for a number of reasons. They insisted on changing the location of a lot of the scenes. Slughorn's first Slug Club meeting is in his own room rather than on a train. Yeah. No fight scene at the end between the Death Eaters and the Phoenix lot. Ron, Hermione, Jim, which is actually makes the ending far less exciting than it needs to be.
Or you can say it refines it and makes it a much more intimate and therefore worrying
and
event.
What was with destroying the Weasley's house? Like to see them get out of that one. In HP7 part 1, there was also a distinct lack of verbal description of why something was happening in some parts, which some cinema goers may have found hard to swallow. Overall, a little disappointed, but can't wait for Harry Potter 7. But the ending was anticlimactical, I would suggest to you. Desmond Trevor James Anderson, BA Philosophy and Sociology, pending 2010. Just got home from watching the new instalment. I have to say that I really enjoyed it. Thought there was a level of humour present which hadn't really been a feature of the previous films, which is odd, as it also follows the darkening trend of the Harry Potter franchise.
It does.
Great performance from Jim Broadbent. Really helped the film along and again added some truly comic moments. I think it's worth mentioning the small but impressive contribution of Frank Delane as the adolescent Tom Riddle. He was only in a couple of scenes, but I got a profound chill whenever he made an appearance. And worth saying, he's the nephew of Ralph Fiennes.
So you tell me.
Who, of course, is Voldemort, so,
yes.
Which is quite a nice...
It's got to make sense.
I must admit, says Desmond Trevor James Anderson, I'm no Harry Potter fan and, in fact, have been quite a vehement opponent to the whole dratted movement, but I was given an enjoyable evening at the cinema with this film. Will not be sad to see the release of the final offering, partly out of relief and now partly out of genuine interest.
No, I am genuinely interested. I also should say, for the record, I laughed, I cried, you know, I wanted...
It is the funniest of
there,
the films.
There is, and actually one of the great balancing acts of it is that it does have great humour, but that humour is balanced absolutely by a sense of darkness and a sense of, as I said, genuine impending catastrophe. So that when the thing happens, which of course what happens at the end will of course mirror mirror what happens at the end. So we're kind of getting a pre-echo of what's going to happen anyway. I thought it was really well held together, because usually if you try and mix those two things, you try and mix humour and horror, you put them alongside each other, they can often defuse each other. And I didn't think that happened at all. I also thought, incidentally, it played up the humanity of the kids much more than the last installment, in which they felt much more like pawns to be moved around in a story which was bigger than them, which is, of course, one of the themes of the movie.
Rachel Phelan, these came through on Twitter. I loved it. The humour was truly funny and the darkness just dark enough, and all young actors have improved greatly. Adam Brammer, the unhappy event is highly underplayed, as is the whole film. Big disappointment. Worst one so far, methinks. H. Maxwell Motley says the Half-Blood Prince reveal is a non-event, and the unhappy event didn't feel as sad as the unhappy event in Harry Potter 4.
Which was the death of Sirius Black. I disagree. No, I thought the unhappy event being the death of Sirius Black happened really fast, to the point that you almost didn't notice it. But then, of course, that is actually one of the points of that scene, is that the line between life and death is very, very short. I mean, I genuinely was moved at the same time as being confused by the unhappy event. Sorry, this feels so... It's like having a coded conversation, but we don't want... If you don't know what the unhappy event is, we don't want to say what it is.
Everybody knows. I mean,
apparently everybody does, but some people didn't. So when you said it last week, some people said, thank you for telling me.
Who don't, you know...
I think it's interesting that some people have written in to say it's the worst one, because I think it is going to divide people. I mean, I had one of those really strange experiences when I sat there in the film thinking, gosh, this is really good, this is really good, this is wow, this is really good. And I got up, and the first person I spoke to said, what's that about then? And the last time I remember that happening was I went to see Brazil with my friend Duncan Cooper, and I sat there going, this is amazing. And we walked out in silence, and I turned to him and I went, well, he went, yeah, it was terrible, wasn't it? But in a way, that divisive quality, I think, is quite good. I also think that with time, this will be proven to be right, that it is the second best.
You actually think you're right?
On this particular count, I do.
I still think that people will think, yes, absolutely right, all the way through, very good, but leave with a sense of disappointment, because I think they've misjudged the ending completely, and I think it really undermines everything else.
I think there's something strange about the ending. I confess to you, I don't understand why. And in fact, you and I had talked about it, but is there a reason? Is it because you have to be able to see Harry at that moment? But I just don't know. And considering what a good job they'd done for the rest of it, condensing it, it can't be something that happened accidentally. I mean, there must have been a really big meeting in which they decided to play it in the way they have.
Now, I think we're virtually out of time here. So would you say that Harry Potter's the movie of the week?
I would, actually. I mean, I really, really like Moon. I think Moon is really, really good. And I'd be inclined to say, in fact, Moon and Harry Potter are joint movie of the week. But if you push me one way, just because... And the more people write in say, yes, I think it is.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Hello, me again. To watch my latest reviews, take a trip to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode for the Kermode Uncut blog.